Hey, deserving listeners, I thought I would answer some patron emails. This first email is from middle tier anonymous patron. She says, my psychiatrist recently attempted to initiate a sexual relationship with me. Yikes. You've talked a lot about what it looks like when a psychologist is crossing the line, but in this case, I have a very explicit, very graphic expressions in writing about what he wanted. Okay, just chiming in here. Yeah, I talk about a crossing line or boundary violations or boundary crossings, but I've also made episodes in which clinicians, mental health clinicians, have had sex with their clients or tried to have sex with their clients. It's been a little bit of an odd theme that I've had throughout the years on this podcast, going back many years, and very alarming to me. I think it's in part because it's a problem, obviously, but there's not a lot of places that people can go when they have these experiences because of a lot of reasons. I think one is that there's a general stigma against therapy in general, right? So people don't necessarily want to come forward with even acknowledging that they're in therapy at all. Of course, that's changing in recent years, but it's still kind of a problem, at least, and probably more of a problem in some communities. Also, people don't necessarily know what to do, and there's not a lot of talk about this, so a lot of victims of this won't know where to turn, and where they are told to turn, even if they remember being informed about this or were informed about it, are the licensing boards, and those the licensing boards aren't there necessarily to emotionally take care of the victims. They're there to take the report and do something about it, and they might take months, if not years, to do anything about it. And they're not very good at necessarily communicating with the victims. And a lot of the licensing boards don't know what the fuck they're doing and don't do anything. So there's not a lot of options for people. And I imagine other clinicians who are online can sometimes become these lightning rods for this sort of thing. And we just need to raise awareness that this happens. At times, it's not usual, but it does happen, and that they deserve to get help, and they deserve to have a safety net or some sort of group of people that will be able to support them as they go through it. Years and years ago, I created a Facebook page called Clients Harmed by Therapists, I believe, something like that, and I was advertising it as a place for people who are harmed by therapists to congregate and to talk about their experiences and their feelings. And it was a closed group, meaning that you had to apply to get in, right? And over the years, it grew, kind of slowly over time. But eventually, it just got to be too much for me to manage. And so I handed it over to admins and cut complete ties from the Facebook page, but occasionally the admins, who are doing wonderful work and are very wonderful people to volunteer their time, are doing a lot of work to keep it a place that is safe for people to come forward, to look at the applications of people coming in. It can get very hard to talk about these kinds of things, and it can be very fraught with a lot of issues. So I guess I'm saying that this is a big issue, and patron, I'm just so sorry that that happened. I mean, it's such a violation. We hand ourselves over in so many ways to our mental health clinicians, and to have someone violate us. I mean, to be violated like this from anybody is traumatic, but to be violated by someone that has been given the mantle of authority and of care that we give these people, like myself, for those people to violate that, and for the system to fail the client such that someone like this could be trained or allowed to be this way it's very upsetting. So I'm sorry it happened to you. Going on with your email, it threw me for a loop because I feel like this is a recurrence of past issues that I have with older people in authority. And I admit I probably didn't respond in the negative as forcefully as I should have initially. Just chiming in here. Well, I wouldn't feel bad about yourself. I hope you're not beating yourself up about that. There are a lot of reasons why a client wouldn't respond in the negative, as you put it. One is intimidation or confusion. Another is that you might actually want to entertain it, right? There might be some level of, well, maybe, you know, I don't know what your situation was, but at the very least, you know that you're in danger and the clinician has a lot of the privilege and power. And that's another reason why it's a problem, is because when it comes down to a debate or an evaluation as to who's telling the truth, whether, you know, is the client telling the truth or is the mental health clinician telling the truth, a lot of times society and licensing boards and the justice system will believe the clinician over the client, particularly if the client has some sort of diagnosis, right? And that's a problem, right? That it's a furtherance of the oppression of clients and people with disorders that is very, very unfair. So, I don't know your situation, but I wouldn't blame yourself for not responding forcefully right up front, because that's not usual that people will do that because of the reasons I was saying going on with the email. But after a week or two, I cut off contact and I transferred my prescriptions to my primary care physician and I found a new therapist. I'm going to spend some time trying to figure out how it is that this particular situation seems to be coming up for me. So I'm not sure what you're saying there, patron. Are you saying that this sort of thing happens to you occasionally? I'm not sure, but going on. However, I'm not sure what I should do about my ex-psychiatrist. I wish I was the kind of person who could gather enough outrage to report him, but I really, really don't want to do anything about it. I feel ashamed and guilty that I even left the door open for such overtures. I know, you always say that it's not the client's responsibility, but still. And it's not like I didn't know better. I'm middle-aged and I've been around the block multiple times. Just chiming in here. Well, yeah, patron. So you know that I'm going to say it's not the client's responsibility because it isn't the client's responsibility. It is a very firm principle of treatment. The ethical codes do not apply to the client. They apply to the clinician. Now, of course, as a client, you can't break the law, for example. You can't, like, shoot your therapist. There's a line regarding your behavior. But the line is very broad, or the range is very broad for a client. You know, I've had clients full-on hit on me sexually. Not physically, but they will proposition me. And that is fine. I'm not excited about it, but if a client is going to do that to me, now I'm a man, so I have the privilege of being able to not feel terrified in a situation like that, but that is not against the rules. It's fine. If a client wants to do whatever they want to do within a certain broad range of options, then that's the material that the client is providing me. There's a reason why the client is doing it. There is a clinical reason for these things. Now, the clinician is supposed to keep an eye on themselves and have training and supervision. I mean, it didn't come out of nowhere in all likelihood for the psychiatrist. It's not like it was, you know, it didn't go from seed to sapling to tree in one session. It probably was something that was growing over a long period of time. And for this clinician to just let that happen without any guardrails, without any measures taken, which in all likelihood were not taken because they usually aren't, is abhorrent and completely against the standard of care. So when we look at your psychiatrist's behavior versus yours, I mean, you're saying that you just weren't particularly negative about it, but then you say shortly after that that you quit after one or two sessions. But even if you hadn't quit after one or two sessions, I wouldn't blame you or think of you as even, you're not even 0.1% of the problem is the thing. So even if you were entertained, you know, you say, I feel ashamed and guilty that I even left the door open for such overtures. I don't want to berate you, patron. I feel like I am. But leaving the door open. I mean, so for me, if I had a client who quote unquote left the door open for me to have sexual overtures with the client, what does that even mean? I mean, what a client, I don't know, dresses a certain way or is entertaining certain boundary violations. You know, if I were to text a client at 9 p.m. at night and then my client text, you know, if I text something friendly, like I say, oh, I just saw Star Wars. Did you see it? And then the client says, oh, I saw it too. I liked it. I guess you could argue that that's quote unquote leaving the door open. The client is leaving the door open for me to text more, but that is not the client's problem. That is the fucking therapist's problem. And even if you were to convince me, patron, that you were like actively seducing the psychiatrist, that is still not your responsibility. It is the clinician's responsibility. To be a therapist is a very high responsibility on so many levels. And we have systems to help us with that responsibility. We're not on our own. We have training. We have research. We have colleagues. We have consultants. We have supervisors. There's resources. And if someone doesn't avail themselves of that, then that is on them and not on you. So, okay. Going on with your email. Do I have an ethical responsibility to do something? Right. So you were asking that you don't want to report it. And so you're asking, do I have an ethical responsibility? Again, you have no ethical... Now, if we're talking about just general human ethics, then I think what you're asking is, do I have a moral slash ethical slash societal responsibility to report the psychiatrist such that the psychiatrist might not be able to do this again? Or if there are other reports, maybe they need one more report in order to take action against the psychiatrist. And what I'll say to that is, no, you do not have a responsibility to do something if you don't want to. I guess you could argue that if there weren't any kind of barriers to you internally or externally to reporting, then you could argue that, well, it would be a greater good for society if you did make that report. But if you, the way you phrase it, I really, really don't want to do anything about it. I don't know why you don't want to do it, but I can imagine a lot of reasons why you wouldn't want to do anything about it. It's a pain in the ass. You'd potentially have to see him again. There could be a court hearing down the line. You might have to write out a report. You might have to make public statements in front of random people like judges and lawyers. You might be cross-examined. You might take action and then nothing happens. That your psychiatrist could bring up things against you that you don't want to be out there. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why you wouldn't want to report. So, you know, but if there isn't any kind of concern along those lines, then yeah, I suppose someone might say that. But in no way would I fault anyone. In fact, most people don't report for a lot of valid reasons. And the problem is that we have a society that will punish victims in situations like that through the system, right? You know, the things that I said that could happen to you, like cross-examination and that kind of thing, is a part of the system such that it punishes victims, right? In the same way that people who are assaulted by a police officer or a teacher or even their own spouse or something, there's the elements in the system are punishing of victims. Now, there are certain elements of the system that need to be in place, like a legal hearing and this kind of thing, but there are things that can be done to protect victims, like allowing them to write a statement or allowing them to respond maybe to cross-examination in writing or something instead of having to be on the stand, right? I don't know, but there are things that they do, like with children, for example, during hearings involving the parents. They'll have the kid be questioned on videotape, and then the videotape will be presented in court, right? There are things you can do, but do I fault you for not doing anything? No, absolutely not. You're the victim. You went through something horrific that you might be dealing with for the rest of your life, even though you say that you've been around the block a few times. You also say you got out relatively unharmed, which I'll take your word for that. You say, you know, I got out relatively unharmed. Which, you know, again, I'll take your word for that. I'm not going to say that you're not accurate there. So I'll take your word for it. But you say, you know, do I have an ethical responsibility to do something? No. Or can I just move on with my life? Yes. Would I be complicit in any future indiscretions if I don't do anything? No, you're not complicit. If and when he does anything in the future to another client or anyone else for that matter, you are not an accomplice to the crime. And this line of thinking is driving me fucking nuts, by the way. The amount of public blaming and shaming of people today is just out of control. I have been targeted recently about things that you could imagine what those would be. And I just want to tell everyone, like, I'm just a human being. And you, patron, are just a human being. You're just trying to live your life. And there are consequences to taking action. It's not easy necessarily to take action. And everyone needs to just stick to their own lane, you know? I don't shame other people for not taking action in situations like this, you know? Or in other kinds of public discourses. I just think everyone has to figure it out for themselves. And now, should we all think about our social responsibility? Absolutely, including in situations like this, like Patron is mulling over. But this automatic notion that somehow by not reporting, you're an accomplice or complicit or you're a part of the problem, things are more complicated than that, people. So no, Patron, you're fine. In fact, you're golden. You're the victim. And you don't have to do shit. And if anyone or any internal voice tells you otherwise, tell that voice or that person to go to hell. All right, let's take a break. All right, we're back from the break. Let's do an OPP. These people became patrons all the way back in 2021. These are all monthly deserving listeners. We have Christine from Columbus, Ohio, JS from Delanco, New Jersey, Danielle from Detroit, Michigan, Marcel from the Netherlands, Jan from Escondido, California, Elba from Eugene, Oregon, Stephanie from Illinois, Galesburg, Illinois, Catherine from Glen Allen, Virginia, and Nope from Hillsborough, Oregon, and Ioana from the Netherlands. Sorry for butchering your name there. Ioana or Yana? I'm not sure. Rachel from Honolulu, beautiful Honolulu. I'm jealous, Rachel. Oliver from Hudson, New York. Reno from Jersey City, New Jersey. Amy from Jonesboro, Georgia. Julia from Las Vegas, Nevada. And Devin from Lockport, New York. Thank you, y'all, for being a patron and staying a patron for over 2.5 years-ish. I also want to remind everyone that this business of psychology in Seattle is almost carbon neutral. You could argue we are completely carbon neutral as a business. I don't know if that matters to you. It certainly does to me. One, I spent a lot of money on getting very expensive solar panels for my house, which is a bit of a farce since I live in Seattle, in which there's not very much sun, but every photon helps. And our business is at home, so a lot of our photons and electrons come from the sun. Also, Washington State has a lot of its energy provided by renewable sources, you know, hydro and nuclear. Of course, there are problems with hydro, but in terms of carbon, it is wonderful on that front. And I just wanted y'all to know that because I want to do what I can. And if you're consuming this podcast, listening to it, or contributing monetarily, I just thought, you know, it's one of those things that you kind of look for, right? Like you want ethical, you want to spend your money on ethical practices. And I would like to think that we're doing our best here. Also, I want to remind patrons of the charities that we give to. We have given thousands of dollars to scholarships and art grants, but mainly scholarships. And we've given a lot of money to Pet Finder, which helps animal shelters and rescue groups care for homeless pets and helps them to connect with homes in need. And Plymouth Housing Group, which helps provide transitional housing for those in need, mainly in the Seattle area. Camp 10 Trees, which is a camp that provides a safe place for queer youth here in Washington. The Trevor Project, which is a national or international charity that helps to prevent suicide among queer youth. The Special Olympics, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the Animal Aid and Rescue Foundation, or ARF, the Prevent Child Abuse America organization, Animals Lebanon, which rescues pets in Beirut and connects them with loving homes. Two of my cats came from Animals Lebanon. They're from the streets of Beirut, if you remember my cats that are no longer with me because they grew old and unfortunately died. And the Environmental Defense Fund, all these charities are money that you give to as patrons, I should say. The patrons give money and part of your, and I guess you YouTube members as well. The Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund. We also give money to Wikipedia and also to Doctors Without Borders. I give money to Wikipedia because I find it to be a wonderful resource. The more technical pages aren't super reliable, but it's free and it, I think, exhibits the original mindset of the internet, which was to level the playing field and to democratize information and not, I hope you get my point. So I like the mission and what they accomplish. But as I said, it's not always reliable, but it's more reliable than a lot of other resources. All right, this next email is from good old middle tier patron Jocelyn G. She says, Kirk's conceptualization of avoidant attachment being preoccupied underneath has really helped me parse my borderline personality disorder splitting. All right, just chiming in here to explain a little bit about the complicated but very competent sentence that Jocelyn just laid out there. So the avoidant attachment, meaning that for some people they develop a way of reacting to attachment threat, attachment loss, by avoiding or dismissing, sometimes preemptively, right? And then saying, my conceptualization that avoidant attachment being preoccupied underneath, meaning that I will point out that for every, often what people will say is that, you have preoccupied people who are very oriented towards relationships and very concerned and worried about losing attachments. Then you have avoidant people who avoid. But I think the way that people think of avoidantly attached people is that they don't care about attachments. But that couldn't be farther from the truth. They deeply, deeply care, of course. They've just turned themselves off to that caring, depending on the degree of avoidant attachment. And so a way of trying to quickly demonstrate that or explain it is that underneath every avoidant person is a preoccupied person, but they just don't have access to it. At least preoccupied people have access to their desperation and avoidant people don't. You could argue that avoidant people have a muted version of preoccupation underneath because they're perhaps neurologically different because of their development in a neglectful attunement space, such that they don't feel emotions quite as big and their desperation might be muted because of that. But like I said, at least preoccupied people are hypervigilant to gain at least some attachment security in bursts, right? They fall in love quickly and they get some fulfillment, whereas avoidant people, they might just avoid chronically and never act on their need for attachment. And so and in the same way that I say for every narcissistic person, they have a borderline person underneath that, which is very true. If you actually get to know people with legit narcissistic personality, deep down, they are exactly the same as a borderline person. They are they have a very hard time knowing who they are or what they want or what their emotions are or that they matter. They can become unglued very easily. Anyway, so that's what I am saying about that. And then what Jocelyn is talking about borderline splitting is that it's a term that we use not only in psychoanalysis, but also in describing borderline, in which for people suffering from borderline personality, they will tend to have these vacillations between desperately loving someone. And it doesn't always play out this way, but a sort of a classic presentation is the person with borderline will just say with me, say a borderline client comes in my office. I don't know the client has borderline and they're being very receptive to my therapy. They really enjoy my therapy. They seem to exhibit a lot of positive client traits, like they do their homework and they're very pleasant in therapy and they compliment me a lot or something. And then I do something that hurts the client's feelings, like say I'm a little late to a session, which would never happen, of course, because I'm aggressively anal about that, as y'all know, which doesn't make me a lot of friends because people are like, Kirk, calm the fuck down. And I'll say, okay, sorry. And but let's say I'm late in this weird universe and the client is hurt by that naturally, but because of the abandonment and betrayal that the client has been through, the traumas, the client very quickly becomes very, very hurt and will split into this other part of themselves where they become very angry and dismissive of me and blaming of me. And I'm suddenly not only just someone that hurt them, but I'm the worst person on the planet. And they believe that to be true. And they embody this split off part of themselves, or they, that's where the, or, well, there's a lot I could say about splitting. Maybe one day I'll do, I mean, I do plan on doing a deep dive on defense mechanisms, of which you could argue splitting is one of them. And each one of the defense mechanisms would require maybe its own deep dive. But I do want to do it for y'all, but also kind of for my own sake, because I know a lot of these terms and I've used them over the years, but it'd be nice to have like a real formalized understanding of it. That's the beauty of being a podcaster that y'all are patrons for, is that I get paid to spend like a month learning about something like splitting and then I can regurgitate it to y'all. But anyway, so, and by the way, I'm currently working on this, on the schizoid deep dive that should be out, shortly, I hope. And I've been working on it off and on for months now, but with splitting, the idea, one version of it, if you will, is that the individual will have a split in their personality, not in that they have multiple personalities, but it's a different mode. One way to think about it for you internal family systems folks is that there's different parts of the self, right? And when the client is with me and being very solicitous to me and being very nice to me and maybe even worshiping me, it's a part of them that is, say, I don't know how they would phrase it to themselves, but a client might phrase it as, well, this is my inner child that is very desperate for love and attention from an authority figure and is very innocent and trusting. But I have another part of myself in this internal family system of the fighter, the, you know, the sergeant who comes forward to defend that little girl on the inside of me. And so these two parts of the self become split and not integrated and become very pronounced. And the individual, when push comes to shove, they won't just, you know, in a perfect world or in a healthy, recovered personality, the individual, we all have these aspects to ourselves. You know, I have that inner girl inside of me. I also have that sergeant inside of me. But the hope is that eventually you get to what we call integrated place, where I have access to all those parts of me and all those feelings and all those thoughts relatively. You know, it's impossible to have access to everything all the time, but that I don't have to completely go full sergeant. You know, I don't have to go completely full inner child or completely full sergeant. I can notice my inner child while also noticing my sergeant, while also noticing five other kind of impulses that I have, and in a differentiated way, kind of look at it all and figure out what I want to do with it. Whereas with people who go through, you know, significant traumas and neglect growing up, they either retain, you could argue, or develop this splitting aspect where they are one or the other. And the idea is that early in development, all children are like this. You might notice your child is like this, that when they're 2 years old, you know, they love you if things are going well. And then say you frustrate them somehow, like they have to go down for a nap, or you have to say, okay, it's time to walk away from the playground, or we have to leave grandma's house. That child will just turn on you. You know, they're just like, you are the devil. Now, it's so normal and it's so expected and so kind of cute, that, or I don't know, depending, that we don't look at it like the child is, you know, completely splitting, but it is. You look at the child, you're just like, come on, there's limits in life, and I'm not the devil. I was the one, it was my idea to come to grandma's. We wouldn't be at grandma's if it weren't for you. So, you know, cut me some slack here, but some kids, you know, particularly before a certain age, will just, you know, all bets are off. You're the devil now. You're horrible. So for people that are abused or neglected growing up, you could argue that they never grow out of that. So that's what I think Jocelyn's talking about with borderline splitting. And so for borderline individuals, they will, you know, split those two aspects, or what we call splitting off of those two modes, because they can't tolerate, you know. Another way of looking at it is that for the borderline client that is idealizing me, they can't tolerate any threat to that idealization, because that client believes that if they stray from idealization, even a hair's width, then everything bad will happen and they will lose me. And so they split off all of their negative feelings and all of their criticisms and all of their misgivings about me, but they don't go away. They just get split off to the sergeant, if you will. And then as soon as there's enough reason for the sergeant to emerge, then, and again, it's not multiple personalities, it's not alters, it's not dissociative identity, it's just different modes that people go into, then that sergeant will come forward and ruin things, right? Because if it's just the sergeant, then the sergeant just is like a bull in a china shop and just completely destroys all relationships instead of just mildly trying to modify them. You know, anyway. So Jocelyn's talking about that. My splitting feels like snap avoidance after fierce preoccupation, but the preoccupation was always there and the avoidance is just a way to try to cope. Just chiming in again, you know, very sophisticated bit here. What she's saying is, for me with my borderline, when I split, it feels like, because I think what Jocelyn's talking about is, one of the things I talk about is that a lot of preoccupied or borderline individuals will come to me and they'll say that they don't feel like they're completely preoccupied. They'll say, you know, I'm both avoidant and preoccupied because sometimes I avoid. And sometimes with investigation, I will conceptualize the person as being partially one and partially the other. Like for me, I am partially, I'm mostly secure, but I am also avoidant and I have a dash of preoccupied. So I, you know, there's not, that's not counter to the way I see things and not counter to the research. But what I will sometimes find, though, is that when I hear that from someone, that particularly if they are moderate to severe preoccupied or borderline, I will find after an investigation that they're not actually avoidantly attached. They don't tend to react that way. They just avoid as an offshoot from their preoccupation when things become so bad and so distressful that they just have to run away from an individual or from relationships in general. But the theme throughout the whole thing is preoccupation. You know, for people who are avoiding, who have, you know, sort of classic dismissive avoidant attachment, they wouldn't word it that way. They would just say like, yeah, you know, I just don't really need people, or I don't know, people get on my nerves. So, you know, they don't word it like, things just got so bad. I was just so desperate. So I just had to completely just end my life dating. And it's a different way of wording it, because it's a different experience. You know, the preoccupied individual who avoids, you know, because I've had clients come to me who are very preoccupied in my conceptualization, but say they had 5 years where they didn't date anybody. And that would look like an avoidant person, but throughout every day, perhaps, of that preoccupied, particularly if it's moderate to severe, there's a lot of preoccupied themes and feelings and thoughts that are running through that individual's head, even though they aren't dating. You know what I mean? Anyway, so what Jocelyn is saying is, you know, my splitting, when I go from you know, preoccupied to avoidant, I think that's how Jocelyn is using it, that it feels like my snap avoidance is after a lot of fierce preoccupation, meaning a lot of fear and a lot of hypervigilance, a lot of pain. And the preoccupation is still going on. The preoccupation was always there, and the avoidance is just a way to try to cope. Right, going on. I separately wonder about this. Might disorganized attachment feel like simultaneous and fierce preoccupation? Very complicated, Jocelyn. Let me slow down here. Might disorganized attachment, okay, feel like simultaneous fierce preoccupation and avoidance, so fierce preoccupation and fierce avoidance, at the same time, such that they cancel each other out and all that's left is despair? End of email. I mean, you could see it that way. That's not how I see it, if I'm understanding you right. With disorganized attachment, it's almost like a completely different thing. It often is framed as this combo between avoidance and preoccupation, or dismissive and anxiously attached, but that doesn't describe it in my mind. And it actually took me a while to kind of comprehend this. When I did the deep dive on attachment a few years ago, I didn't, in my estimation, understand disorganized attachment really until, I don't know, maybe like a few months after I did the deep dive. Stacy recently reran the deep dive, and I was listening back to it, and I was kind of cringing at what I was saying about disorganized. I mean, it wasn't wrong, but it wasn't right. So the right, or what I believe humbly to be the right way of describing disorganized attachment, is that with preoccupied folks, when they have an attachment threat, when they feel like they're going to lose someone, or they are lonely, or they're hurt by someone, they at least have a way of reacting, which is to lean in and to be hypervigilant, or to get angry, or to be desperate, or to cling, or something. And avoidant people, when they feel attachment threat, they have a way of reacting. They avoid. They shut down. They say they're independent and they don't need anybody. They drink or do something that's compulsive, like masturbation or porn or drug abuse or working too much or something. You know, they have a way. They're both suffering, and particularly with severe avoidant and severe preoccupied, you know, there's tremendous suffering on the level of severe personality disorders, perhaps. But with disorganized folks, they don't have any way of dealing with it. When they feel attachment threat, which can be frequent, they don't know what to do. There's nothing to do. They will do something, because humans can't help but to do things, but there's no pathway. There's no habit of, how do I get out of this problem? You know, to the preoccupied person, that if you ask them, okay, how do you repair your relationship? They'll say things along the lines of, well, I just need to get him to therapy, or I just need to get him to understand my feelings. You know, there's an orientation towards the other person of, I just need to orient, or I need to game the system. I need to figure out how to tinker with me or this other person such that we can finally get to that great place. And to the avoidant person, you know, there'll be an orientation of just like, well, I just need to get my life in order, or I just need to take a break from humans for a while, or I just need to improve my personal coping with emotions. Not that that's a bad thing, but it could be a part of a bad thing. There'll be something that they'll say to a disorganized person. They'll just say, they might say things, but they don't feel confident in anything that they're doing. Not that preoccupied people necessarily feel confident, but at least they have a compulsion and a direction. And there's a chance that it actually might work for preoccupied people and for avoidant people, particularly for avoidant people. Research shows that for avoidant folks, their life tends to go a little better, which is, I think, a result of our culture being kind of fucked up and privileging avoidant people. Not quite sure, but for disorganized folks, it's a constant level of distress. They move away from the pain and they're alone and they're in distress. They move towards the relationship and the pain, and they feel increased pain and fear, and they move away and they feel fear. They move towards, they feel fear. They don't know, they can't depend on themselves as well. There's nowhere to turn. They can't go any direction, and it's very, very unsettling and very, very distressing. So to say that, you're describing it as, and I don't know exactly what you're saying, Jocelyn, but from the way it looks, you're saying might disorganized attachment feel like simultaneous fierce preoccupation and fierce avoidance at the same time, that they cancel each other out. Maybe you could word it that way, but I don't. I find that once I landed on the way I just described it earlier, it all made sense to me. It even makes sense in terms of childhood development. When the child is 12 months old and they are being abused and they have an instinct to run to their parents, but their parents are the ones abusing them. So they have an instinct both to run toward and away from the parents, so they don't know what to do. Whereas in the for the preoccupied kid, they at least have some little bits of safety at times if they do run toward and cling to their parents. There's at least some some oasis that happens at times. It's very infrequent, but it happens at times. To the avoidant person, there's at least some safety in moving away and shutting down eye contact and trying not to signal that they have needs. The child is essentially rewarded either direction. The avoidant child is rewarded for being avoidant and for lacking eye contact and being independent because the parent no longer is distressing the child. The preoccupied child is rewarded at times for clinging and being desperate and asking or demanding or something. There's bits of reward. To the disorganized kid, there's no reward any direction they go. You're fucked no matter which direction you go. And, you can see how it would be a very, very distressing place to be, which it is. But there's treatments, I've talked about it a lot with Bob. All right, let's take another break. All right, back from the break. Let's do another OPP. These people became patrons all the way back in 2021. These are all monthly deserving listeners. We have Christina from London. We have Zena from Longmont, Colorado, or Longmont, or I don't know. Makoto from Linwood, Washington, just north of here. Joanna from also Linwood. Makoto and Joanna, do you know each other? Joanne from Melbourne, Australia. Memily from Merrill, Michigan. Mars from Miami, Florida. Sophia from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I've been there. And Miami. Amanda from Nellisford, Virginia. Mackenzie from Texas. Julia from Newport, Oregon. Vicky from California. Connor from Oakfield, New York. Elizabeth from Olympia, Washington. Good old Olympia. Jesse from Omaha, Nebraska. And Anonymous from Palmdale, California. And John from Plano, Texas. Thank you so much for being a patron and staying a patron for so long. It is the wind beneath my wings, figuratively, but literally it is, you pay my bills. You literally pay my bills. You literally pay my mortgage, because I wouldn't, if you didn't do that, patrons, and peek behind the curtain, you're the main source of my bill paying, by the way, patrons. And if you didn't do that, I'd have to go back to my various other jobs, and I would have to go back to making one shitty podcast episode every 2 or 3 weeks, which is the way things used to be. So thank you so much. All right, this next email is also from Jocelyn, but it's a quick one, so I'll just get to this real quick. Jocelyn says, what can I do to reassure myself that things won't fall apart at work while I'm away? I frequently feel things are not done up to standard at work, and I dread the thought of work getting done improperly or inefficiently by others when I'm out on vacation. I compensate by creating copious documentation, manuals, and notes for processes to be helpful during my absence, but I can't know if people will actually read them. Thank you so much. End of email. She wrote end of email. So, yeah. Well, there's a lot I can say to this. One is I get it because I'm like that as a perfectionist. I would feel that way when I worked at the university full time, and it would drive me nuts. So, yeah, that's just a personal issue that maybe needs to be worked on. But another factor is that managers, of course, want us to believe what you believe, Jocelyn. They want us to have this feeling because what it does to us is it makes us have to work much harder and many more hours outside of vacation so that management can get the most out of labor for the least amount of money, which is unfair, right? So I personally, when I hear this from you, Jocelyn, I think this isn't your fault. I mean, unless you're the business owner, I suppose, but if you're not, this isn't your fault. This is the manager's fault or the owner's fault. You know, whoever is above you, whoever could hire more people, because this is a hiring more people or hiring better people problem. It's not a you problem. And this is something that I am frequently talking about, you know, to advocate for labor, that there's a cultural shift, particularly in Seattle, I think, that is different than before. When I was younger, there was a pretty strong ethic around, at least in my circle, of you work for 40 hours a week and no more than 40 because of laws. And when you take vacation, you just take vacation. You don't have to do anything, maybe a little bit of prep to get everyone up to speed before you go out of town. And when you're on vacation, you don't need to have access to email or text or anything. You're just gone, right? Because of course, in the past, they didn't have that. And then when you get back, you don't have to do extra work because that's the definition of a vacation. The way it's dealt with today is, culturally speaking, you know, and management just, you know, is giggling themselves asleep every night because we're doing this to ourselves, is that we take all the work that we aren't doing while we're on vacation for that week or 2 weeks, and we're just piling it up before and after the vacation. That is not a fucking vacation. That is unpaid leave because you're working twice as hard before and after the vacation so you can take time off. That's just unpaid leave. That's not paid vacation. And for all of us as labor to just go along with that is anti-American for me. America, at least in the past century, in the 20th century, after labor laws were put into effect, we are a country of labor. We are a country of labor rights and unions, and fuck the man. You know, there was a time when the industrialists and the capitalists exploited labor and children and, you know, killed all sorts of people with unsafe work conditions. And we, the people, employed our politicians to push back on that. And we, the people, joined unions. And we, the people, did all sorts of things to advocate for us against the capitalist. And for us to just give into that right now and to have no awareness that we're doing this to ourselves is we're harming ourselves, you know? So, because the equation is that in order for you to just work for 40 hours and just casually take a vacation and then casually come back to work, in order for that to happen, the equation is that the ownership and the capitalists, they have to lose some of their profit. They'll still be profitable. Otherwise, they should just go out of business because they don't have a workable business, but because their business shouldn't be dependent on exploiting labor. So for you to just be able to casually go on vacation and come back and ramp up normally to your job, for that to happen, they typically have to hire more labor, or they have to hire a temp or somebody. And what that means is that the capitalists have to lose profit, which is the way things should be. It should not be on us to carry that burden so that the rich can get richer, which is what's happening, right? And we, the people, have to fight back. We have to speak out. We have to organize. We can't just say to ourselves, I'm not going to do that, because if you don't do that, you will be fired, or you'll be ostracized or marginalized somehow. We as a group have to say no to Microsoft, no Amazon, no Starbucks, no Boeing, no Costco. I'm just naming all the Seattle businesses. No, we will not do that. And you can't make us. And if you hire scabs, we will all quit. You will make a little less money, Jeff Bezos, or you will make no money, because that is the American way. So when I hear you, Jocelyn, talking about that you're stressing out before going on work because you have to create all of this oversight that your coworkers or your underlings or whoever have to follow, and you don't even know if they will, and it like really stresses you out before and after and during a vacation, that is on the capitalists. That is not on you. And that's another philosophy to take on that I tell people. It's like, look, why are you on this planet? Are you on this planet to earn money for the capitalists who own your business? And I don't know, Jocelyn, maybe you literally own the business. Maybe you are the capitalist. I don't know. The way you're wording it doesn't sound that way to me. But the point is that why are we on this planet? You know, we're not put on this planet to put more money in rich people's pockets. And so, I'm just not going to do that. And this is the way I have tried to live my life. I don't know where I got this from. I certainly wasn't taught it growing up. I think it's part of just my general entitlement. I feel entitled to a life, and when I feel pressure to pull away from that life, I don't like it. And so I look into like, well, what's happening exactly? And over time, I just started to cobble together this idea. And so when I worked at the university, I would call upon these principles and push back on my boss and on administration, particularly as a way of saying, no, you can't do that to us. I'm not going to do it. And so many people would do it because they wanted to be seen as good employees. And I just thought, look, if I get fired, I get fired. I'm just not going to live in a system like that. The other thing is that I had a good boss. Paul was my boss, and would fight to the death for me, and often would. Sometimes I'd have to not tell Paul, my boss and mentor, about ways I was being mistreated because I didn't want him to go after these people. I would tell him because, I was often the new guy. And so funny that I could be working at a university for 15 years and be considered the new guy. That's the way things were back then. Now the professors at Antioch are all, newly hired, or a lot of them are. But back in the day, it was this set of professors. Anyway, I'm rambling. But I recommend that, I don't know, Jocelyn, if that's part of it. But like I said earlier, I get it. As a perfectionist, it's just one of those things that it's just hard. I don't know. Maybe telling the people around you before you go on vacation, be like, hey, if you care about me at all as a human being, y'all are going to do your best to try to uphold the standards that we have here that I'm usually carrying the weight of. And maybe that's another thing. Like, in between vacations, you can raise the topic of, hey, coworkers, I feel like I'm carrying the burden of quality assurance in this workplace, and I like that, but it's too much. So, because in a system, if you end up being that person, other people can feel like, well, Jocelyn's taking care of that, so I don't need to. And so maybe if you start ramping that down, other people will have to pick up the slack there. I don't know. I don't know if that's another thing to think about. Right, this next email is from middle tier anonymous patron. She says, I'm sure it's more complex than this, but I was reading about the difference between shame and guilt. And it, so just chiming in here. There's a lot of talk online, and I think it's been around for a while, about the difference between shame and guilt. And I'm not opposed to it, but I think that it's more complicated often for people. What do we mean by shame? What do we mean by guilt? And there's a lot of absolutist talk about shame. You might hear me talk about this sometimes, that shame is always bad and guilt is can be good and can be bad or something like that. Because shame is when you feel like you are bad, whereas guilt is when you think that you did a bad thing. And it, you know, there's a lot of nuance to that. And I also think that at times, feeling like you are bad is probably a good idea. I want Ted Bundy to be ashamed of himself. I want someone who is abusive to be ashamed of themselves. I don't want them to hate, but then it leads to this other conversation of like, well, what if you think you have something inherently wrong with you and your personality? I mean, I've thought about that myself. And so I'll just speak for myself that when I was in my 20s, mid-20s, and I was training to be a therapist, I asked around. I'd been in therapy before, but I was looking for a new therapist, and I asked for a therapist that would quote-unquote kick my ass. And boy, did I find a therapist in Seattle that would kick my ass. And he confronted me, you know, not in an abusive way, but in a very pointed way throughout my time with him, which was, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. And I, over time, would develop this cringe, sweaty feeling on the way to therapy that I could absolutely describe as shame, because it had that, it didn't have, I didn't feel guilty when I was driving to therapy. I felt shame. I felt like there was something wrong with my personality, and I felt bad about a lot, not just about a small set of things that emerged from that personality trait, but I felt bad for my entire life, the things that had emerged from that personality trait that I was investigating and that he was confronting me on. I felt cold sweats and that sinking feeling in my chest as I was driving to therapy. I would frame that absolutely as shame. The difference is that I had a way forward, and my therapist was not rejecting me as a human being, and I was not rejecting myself as a human being. So shame in itself is not, in my book, a bad thing. It can be a bad thing because, of course, if someone doesn't have that support or those inner resources or the differentiation, or they don't have a history that I have, which is one of mainly secure attachment and self-esteem, if they don't have those things, then the shame will run deep and run wild and will destroy the individual, right? They will fall deep in the shame. They will have no way out. They will fall into addiction or self-hatred or some other destructive path, maybe even suicide. So for some people, and I'm not saying I'm particularly rare, but it's not uncommon for someone to have a really hard time with shame, right? And for me, I can absolutely develop a problem with shame, and I have. I have things that I have frequent shame about today, like with my OCPD, right? With my worry about having flaws, and thus that's a reason for me to be completely rejected as a human being. That is shame as well. So to me, it's complicated and nuanced, guilt and shame. And for others, they don't necessarily see it that way. And that's fine. But what I have a problem with is when people tell me that I'm wrong for the way that I frame and linguistically word things. I have a problem with that. Plus, in the research, it's not the way that people talk about it. You know, in the clinical research in psychology, the research on emotion, on shame and guilt, it's not simplified the way that the internet tends to do it. And a lot of people think that when I say shame can be okay sometimes, they think that I'm saying y'all should hate yourself. And I just find that to be odd, considering the fact that I yammer so much. It's pretty rare if I just say something off the cuff and just expect y'all to understand what I'm saying. If anything, I over-explain things, you know what I mean? So middle tier anonymous patron, you say, I'm sure it's more complex than this, but I was reading about the difference between shame and guilt, and it just made me wonder whether survivor's guilt rather than shame is functional, because by overestimating, I think this is one long sentence, so I got to take this in parts. It made me wonder whether survivor's guilt, meaning that if, for example, you were in a family that had a lot of abuse from the parents and you actually weren't abused very much. For people that watched Love is Blind Season 5, JP, I think, had this kind of survivor's guilt, unfortunately, because, you know, he didn't deserve to feel guilty for that as a child that grew up in an abusive family, but he witnessed his sisters being abused, according to him. Anyway, so made me wonder whether survivor's guilt rather than survivor's shame is functional, because by overestimating your capacity to predict events and act based on these predictions, you predict that if the situation were to reoccur, you would have the capacity to avoid the same outcome if you were just willing to do so, not selfish, just worked on yourself. Okay, that's the end of that sentence. Okay. I don't know if we're using the same definition of survivor's guilt, anonymous patron. Maybe it sounds like you're talking about self-blame of trauma or self-blame of someone else's harm of you. Because you say, by overestimating your capacity to predict, because I think what you're saying, patron, is self-blame functional, because what it does is it makes us try to learn how to avoid situations that would recreate this in the future, and that if we don't at least somewhat blame ourselves, we might be susceptible to haphazardly walking into harm in the future. You know, like if someone said, this is a horrible example, but if someone, a woman dressed in a very revealing dress or something, not very, but somewhat revealing dress, and she is going to the clubs by herself, which should be completely fine, by the way, because it's not inherently some sort of ticket to abuse her, right? So she goes to a nightclub by herself, and then she walks to her car, and someone attacks her, and she is irrationally blaming herself, at least to some extent, saying, I shouldn't have worn that, or I should have parked closer, or I should have had a buddy or something like this. And, you know, there's a difference between noting the factors that led to one's harm, you know, that resulted in harm to oneself. There's a big difference between that and self-blame, or what I think you're calling a survivor's guilt, but I think you're talking about self-blame. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. There's a big difference between shame and guilt. You know, if that woman were to say, well, of course I'm not to blame because I should be able to wear a dress and go to a nightclub and walk to a car. It's not anywhere even close to my fault that happened. It'd be hard. I can't imagine a woman saying that to herself in today's society, but she deserves to say that to herself. But at the same time, she says, and unfortunately, I have to deal with this bullshit, so in the future, I will do X, Y, and Z instead of what I did. That's different, right? That's not guilt or shame. That's just noting the factors and the context. Whereas if she were to say, I can't believe I wore that dress. I should have known better. I'm so stupid. I'm so irresponsible. There's something wrong with me. Everyone always tells me that I shouldn't be so slutty. I shouldn't. What was I even doing at a nightclub trying to meet people? Like I should go to church more often. That's very different. And the difference is not only in the way I describe it, which is, you know, learning from an experience versus complete self-destruction based on internalized voices, but also that shame and guilt often will prevent the individual from actually learning from the scenario, or they learn the wrong lesson, right? They learn that they can't ever wear a dress or that they deserve to be harmed in this way, right? So the shame and guilt based, if I were to answer your question, if I understand what you're saying, I think you understand what I'm saying, which is that the guilt and the shame that is completely unjustified, not only is it not necessarily helpful, but it could be very unhelpful. It could, and there's a very helpful version of just noting what, you know, like another way to frame it would be that, well, maybe a little bit of, like a little bit of trauma is actually helpful to us, which seems likely. It seems we likely evolved a capacity for trauma reactivity to guide us in future behavior to help us be safe. I always give the example of the saber-toothed tiger coming out at us. I'm not even sure if I remember if saber-toothed tigers were around when early humans were. I mean, certainly hominids were other primates that were similar to us, but so we evolved from those folks on the tree of life. And the now the example I'll give is, yeah, we're walking in the jungle and we hear the snap of a twig. We hear the breathing of an animal that sounds a little strange. And then all of a sudden, rustle of leaves, and a saber-toothed tiger jumps out at us and attacks our brother and kills him. And we get away, and then we encode all of that information, not only the tiger, but that little breath we heard, the snapping of a twig, the rustling of leaves, such that in the future, whenever we hear snap of twig and rustling of leaves, even though it's just a rabbit, we have a reaction, right? Now, if we don't develop PTSD, at the very least, we have some level of trauma reactivity that will, you know, it's better safe than sorry. Okay, fine, it was a rabbit, but what if it was a saber-toothed tiger? It serves us in terms of our survival to have that mechanism that is automatic, that doesn't stop at the, you know, that system of trauma reactivity doesn't check in with our executive functioning, with our prefrontal cortex. It just goes straight to reaction. It's like, it's not exactly like this, but you know, that neurological test that they say, it's like you put your hand on a hot plate and the signal goes up your arm into your spine, and then it doesn't even have to go to your brain to be evaluated. There's a mechanism neurologically, locally in your spine that will pull your arm back, right? I don't know if I'm describing it exactly right, but at least it's a faster process, right? And with trauma, it seemingly we evolved that to help us. Of course, it can be overutilized by our brain if we have chronic trauma, or we don't have aftercare, or we don't have a system to get to safety afterwards, if we don't have support, these kinds of things, or we're prone to that kind of thing, or we've had genetics that led to us being susceptible to that sort of thing. I'm rambling. But yeah, sometimes I'm in the middle of rambling. I'm just like, where the fuck am I? And I think I'll just end the episode right there. No, I'll do a couple more emails. Ooh, I like this email. This is from patron Esmond from Minneapolis. He says, "Hello, Dr. Kirk. What a wonderful year for psychology in Seattle. I hope you and the podcast family and listeners are doing well." Well, Esmond, we are, I think. Going on with the email. "If you had three adjectives or labels to apply to Lorelai Gilmore's parenting of Rory Gilmore, what would they be and why?" So just chiming in here. So this is, of course, from Gilmore Girls, the show that I have watched, maybe 2.5 times. I've watched all the seasons, maybe 3.5. I don't know. I watched it a lot more back in the day when it was on the air, and then I watched it on DVDs afterwards, I think, and then Netflix got it, and then Netflix did like an eighth season that I sort of enjoyed. But anyway, yeah, I love that show. And incidentally, when I first started watching it, I didn't like it because I didn't like how fast they talked. I thought it was really unnatural and disturbing. And I also didn't like Lorelai, the mom. I didn't like her parenting of Rory. It seemed too permissive or lax or something. But once I got used to the rhythms of this writer, you know, because the same showrunner, she makes that show, The Marvelous Miss Maybell or whatever. And it's a very similar kind of aesthetic of quick talking people. Anyway, once I got used to it, I really love the show. And the three adjectives I would say about Lorelai Gilmore and her parenting of Rory is that Lorelai was very loving, very, very loving, very attentive. You know, Lorelai really knew what was going on with Rory. Not all the time. And there were, of course, some personality issues and trauma issues, relational trauma issues of Lorelai that made it harder for her to see Rory at times. And that was a theme of the show, that Lorelai would be imposing certain life choices on Rory, and Rory, given her way, would have not necessarily the assertiveness to push back on it, but would eventually, or might push back in a dysfunctional way to Rory's life, which, you know, is what it's like to be a human, I suppose. But and the third adjective, I would say loving, I would say attentive, and I would say somewhat enmeshed, in my opinion. Now, Esmond, I don't know what words you would say, but I would guess most people would look at Lorelai and think she had bad boundaries, definitely enmeshed, self-centered, narcissistic, this kind of thing. And that is not depicted on the show because, one, Rory is a very well-adjusted kid. She goes through some hard times, but for the most part, she's very well-adjusted. And that's not entirely necessarily an indication of Lorelai's parenting, but it is a strong indicator of good parenting. You know, parenting is about outcomes. It's not about the way you do it. It's about the result. And Rory is a wonderful kid in high school, wonderful kid in college, develops well, has normal issues, you know, but is doing pretty well. Any parent would be proud of Rory. For Lorelai, also, yeah, her parenting style is more, and for the record, I will also say that it's a fictional TV show, of course, so you could argue, well, Lorelai's a terrible parent, but the writers made Rory good because they just wanted the plot to be that way. But I'll say that in my observation, I've seen parents like Lorelai who did work well with kids. You know, parenting is complicated, as I always say, and it's not necessarily what you do, but how you adjust to the individual child. So there's that. But with Rory, or with Lorelai, the mom, what I'll say is that, yeah, on the scale of things, she's pretty permissive. She's pretty boundary crossing with Rory. She treats Rory like a sister at times instead of her own child. For sure. Those are all things you could say, but, and there were consequences of that. You know, we could go season by season or episode by episode and point to problems, but the overall theme, though, you know, the thing to ask is, would you want Lorelai to be your mom? And I would answer that to be yes. I mean, I'd rather have my mom, but if I didn't have my mom, Lorelai would be a great mom. She's very caring, like I said, very attentive. A lot of parents, they're in their own worlds. They have their own issues, and they don't necessarily know what their teenage kids are going through or care. Lorelai deeply, deeply cared about Rory and really wanted the best for her, and involved Rory in a lot of conversations. Some people might say inappropriately, but you know, not really. You know, there are inappropriate things that you can involve your kids in, right? And like the fact that Lorelai shared a lot of her dating life with Rory is, you know, it's a red flag, but it's not necessarily a problem. And I, you know, it's been a while since I've watched all the seasons, and maybe some of y'all that know the story more recently, you might be screaming into your device right now saying like, no. And, you know, I'd concede to your expertise on this, but from my memory, Lorelai was, overall just really, really attentive, very loving, very warm. When push comes to shove, Lorelai would protect Rory and let Rory be Rory. So, can we point to problems? Sure. But I think it's overshadowed by the positives. Then your next question, Esmond, is, do you have any insight into the family dynamics between Emily, Lorelai, and Rory? End of email. Wow. That would be a whole dissertation. I wonder if anyone's ever written a dissertation on Emily, Lorelai. So Emily is the grandmother. So you got Emily and then the daughter, Lorelai, and then the daughter, Rory. And so in a nutshell, Emily was someone that was very high class and very stuffy and judgmental and critical and not warm and not very attentive, but really wanted a connection with Lorelai. But because Lorelai had a rebellious teenage years, there was a real break in Lorelai's relationship with Emily. And you could argue that Lorelai was rebelling against Emily's dominant parenting style. And then when Lorelai had Rory young, I think as a teenager, then Lorelai swung the other direction. But to Lorelai's credit, she was able to build a strong attachment with Rory. You know, I think most people would say that Rory and Lorelai had a good attachment, had a good safety and a good amount of attunement and love between the two of them. Whereas with Emily and Lorelai, it wasn't there. Now, with the triangle, though, with Rory, she didn't have that history with Emily and the grandfather. She liked them, and the grandparents treated Rory a lot better than they treated Lorelai, sometimes in the same scene. And Rory really liked that. And I think also Rory wanted, particularly once she entered her teenage years, she wanted the resources that the grandparents had, you know, because Lorelai, although when you look at Lorelai's house, I mean, it's just a beautiful, beautiful house. It's probably worth a couple million dollars if in Stars Hollow, but she's at least written, Lorelai is written as someone who isn't super rich at the very least. Anyway, but I think that Rory and Lorelai, for that matter, kind of depended on Emily financially and for connections. And I think Emily might have used that to some extent. But Emily had especially as the season progressed, Emily had a real vulnerable side, a real soft, hurt side. So you just got this impression that Emily, the grandmother, had her own history. I'm forgetting if they ever went into that, Emily's childhood. You've got to figure they must have talked about it at some point. But there was triangulation in that Emily and Lorelai had an ongoing conflict between the two of them since Lorelai was a teenager, and they both triangulated Rory that, you know, Lorelai would indicate or talk shit about Emily to gain Rory's allegiance to Lorelai, and Emily and the grandfather would kind of do the same. And what was really happening between the family members was that the grandmother, Emily, and Lorelai were still resenting each other and still hurt by each other. They were both very, very hurt, and they developed a way of coping with that by just avoiding the topic and by having these surface level dinners every Sunday night or whenever it was, and by just existing and trying not to make any waves. But occasionally something would flare up and the old resentments would start to come out between Emily and Lorelai, and often Rory would have to suffer from that, right? I could go on and on, but that's me off the top of my head. Right, this next email is from patron Janice. She says, I just want to thank you for doing this podcast and for answering people's questions. I don't know you, but I respect you and I feel safe with you, which is weird, right? And my favorite thing to fall asleep to is your podcast. Not because it's boring. I take meds that make me sleep, and I love the safety and security that your voice represents. I always listen to the podcast again later so that I can actually learn from it. You should totally record sleep stories with Calm or some other app. Thanks for lulling me to sleep every night. Good night, Janice. End of email. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's honestly, if my podcast did one thing, I would take it if that was to help people sleep, because sleep is so important and feeling safe is so important. So I'm honored by that. And don't ever feel bad that you fall asleep to me, because that's, like I said, it's quite an honor and not what I set out to do, but I'll absolutely take it. And I do that too. I don't listen to things to fall asleep. Well, sometimes I do. If I'm taking a nap, sometimes I will want to listen to something, and I will choose something that will, in that I can predict it won't have any loud, sudden noises, you know. And sometimes I even gauge how long I was asleep by how many minutes went by in the podcast episode that I'm listening to. So, that's great. And I guess it's also double great that you listen to it again so that you can actually learn from what I'm talking about. And then you say I should do sleep stories with the Calm app or something. I didn't even know that that's what they did. I didn't know that this app was, is it some sort of thing that anyone can submit to? I thought it was like the Calm app had all their employees or someone like that, that would do the different Calm or sleep aids, but that's interesting. Yeah. You know, who should do this really is Bob, because people really love his voice. So maybe I'll put him up to it. But, you know, in the meantime, just listen to one of my episodes and fall asleep, just like my wife does when I yammer. This next email is from anonymous middle tier patron. She says, "Oh my God, I relate to this so much." Just chiming in here. She was referring to a reaction video that I was talking about, criticism trauma going on. "Oh my God, I related to this so much. It's interesting to see how the constant criticism from my mom led to a spectrum of the defensive schema among me and my siblings. My brother found escapism in video games. I found it in reading. My sister binge watches shows and doom scrolls on Instagram. It's so confusing because my mom grew up always saying that she needs to stay with us our whole lives because we don't speak up for ourselves." End of email. Yeah, so I think what you're talking about, patron, is that your mom would both criticize you and break you down, and then would sweep in and say, "I'm here to save you. I'm going to speak for you." And it's similar to the mafia. From at least the movies, they would come to a business on the corner and they would say, "Boy, it'd be a shame if someone destroyed your windows that are in the front of your business. You know, if you give us $100 a week, we will protect your business and make sure that no one breaks your window." And the business is, you know, "Guys, I don't need that. It's okay." And then the mafia proceeds to break the windows right in front of them. They say, "Are you sure you don't need someone to protect your windows?" And then the business coughs up $100. And that's what you're describing, what your mom would do. She would break you down and criticize you, say you're incompetent, you're stupid, you're worthless, you're dumb, or whatever. And then she would say, "Oh, good thing I'm here, because I will protect you and I have to speak for you." So it has this kind of gaslighting effect over time where you start to think, "Oh, I guess I do need this. I am incompetent," because your whole world is your mom, right? Your parents, what they think of you, then that's how we think of ourselves, 100%. And then you feel grateful that she's here, and it just creates this ongoing dependency that is very hard to get out of, right? Because whenever you have an impulse to step out from underneath the umbrella of your mom, because you haven't had a lot of experience with independence and you have a lot of internalized voices saying that you're going to screw things up. Whenever you do screw things up, which is going to happen, it just happens in life, then you immediately have all these voices saying, look, and you might even have your mom literally telling you that you're stupid, and then you run back under the umbrella. And at least it's safer, it feels better underneath the umbrella. But the answer to differentiation and health and getting your life the way that you deserve to have it, which is where there's a balance and you get your needs met, is where you're able to break free of that bond and that, well, not bond, but you know, that control and system that your mom has you under, and you're able to have another mentor or parent or someone to help you to guide you, right? And so that's where therapy comes in. Because what often happens is, again, either the person stays underneath the overfunctioner or they find another overfunctioner, right? These individuals that we're describing are very prone to being abused later on because an abusive, controlling, overbearing person fits very well with someone like this, obviously. So it's a really hard thing to get out from under. And like I said, because the individuals don't have practice doing things on their own, they are actually incompetent. And so when they try to be independent, they do screw things up in an age inappropriate way. Like for a 15-year-old, for example, I'll just use myself. When I was a teenager, I at times was a very responsible employee. I would show up on time and I would do my work. I had various jobs as a teenager from 13 to 19. But there were some times when I was very irresponsible. Like there was a time when I was 18 and it was summer after my senior year, and I went to a party at my friend's house for 4th of July, and I had California wine coolers, if you remember, 2 liter, which was the drink of choice back then. And I had not drank alcohol maybe but once before that, I don't know, but I woke up late the next morning, naturally, and I was supposed to work that day, but I forgot. I was supposed to work at Ernst, which was kind of like a Home Depot in the Northwest. And for those who are keeping track, I worked there with Lita, the one of the other first co-hosts of the podcast 15 years ago. And the business called my home, called my parents, said like, "Where's Kirk? He's supposed to be here at 8 or 10 or something." And my parents didn't know where I was because I didn't tell them, because at that age, I just would kind of walk out the door. Not because I hated my parents, but I just had a lot of independence. And so they started calling around to the usual suspects and couldn't find me because I was sort of at a friend of a friend's house in a sense. And by the time they got a hold of me, I called my boss and I was like, "Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot." And my boss was really upset at me. And it's funny, looking back, he was probably like 22 years old or something, maybe 20. He wasn't, but he seemed so old to me. And he's like, "Oh, you know," he was real angry. And in my head, I'm like, you have dozens of employees. It's not like everything hinges on me being there, but still it was irresponsible. It was bad. And you know, he was upset. And in my head, I'm like, okay, fine. Enough of the chastising. You're not my dad. Like, tell me that I did something, fire me or something, but I don't need to listen. So he's kind of getting into the realm of berating me unnecessarily. And I, you know, at first I felt genuinely bad, and I felt bad particularly to my parents having to call all over Kingdom Come to find me. But he's laying into me, and then I saw the future, and I was like, okay, how is this going to play out? So I have to go back to work, and I have to be all begging for his forgiveness, and I have to deal with him like being a dick to me for a while, and I didn't like the job very much anyway. And so on the spot, I just said, yeah, I quit. I just, you know, and I was going to college in like a month, so I wouldn't have been able to work there anyway. And I just thought, Yeah, I quit because I just thought, you know, I don't want to deal with this right now. This is just a summer job. I don't need the money necessarily. There's probably another job I could get. And, so for me, I made that mistake, and that is an 18-year-old sort of thing to do. I didn't do it all the time, but I did do it. The issue is that if you are being criticized all the time and you're made to be very dependent and almost childish in your competence level and your confidence level, then you could be 35 and heading to a job and make a mistake like that, but it looks much worse and people will frame it as much worse because you're 35 and you made an 18-year-old mistake at the age of 35 because you were never allowed to be independent at 18. My parents let me choose where I was going to work. They let me, you know, they told me I was going to get a job, but they didn't tell me where, and they didn't really even tell me where to go. I just had to look around, right? And of course, if you look back in the time scale, when I was 13, it was different. I got a job and it was completely overseen by my parents. They literally would drive me. It was a Chinese restaurant that my sister worked at, by the way. So I worked with my older sister. And it was Sun Sun Chinese restaurant in downtown Issaquah. It was like one of the only three restaurants in town at the time. And at the age of 13, it was a different set of independences that I was expected to exhibit. And I learned from that. So at 18, I had progressed, through other jobs, but I was still incompetent and immature and as reflective of my age, you know? But I learned from it. I learned something when that happened. I learned I shouldn't do that and I should plan ahead, and that if I'm going to drink alcohol, I need to know that I might forget things or something. And, but when you are made to be incompetent and you're criticized, you have all this criticism trauma, then all of that learning gets pushed into the future. So when you're 35, you're learning lessons that you should have learned when you were 15. It's not your fault that it's happening, but it's, you were denied that opportunity to learn those lessons from a parent that pushed you to be a little bit independent within reason and was there for you when you made a mistake, right? And at 35, it's very hard to deal with, such that you might immediately run to an overfunctioner because of how humiliating it is and how scary it is. You know what I mean? So when I work with people in this situation with this kind of criticism trauma, I start from the beginning. I might even frame it like I'm framing it now. Now, anonymous middle tier patron, I don't know if what I'm describing is reflective of your experience. You might actually be talking about something else, but it sounds like what you and your siblings do is you tend to kind of avoid, maybe, and you escape through these different things that you're talking about. So I don't know if I'm understanding what you're saying, which would mean that my entire yammering would be completely off base, which is always possible. All right. Well, that's enough out of me. And everyone, please, 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 please take care of yourself, truly, because you deserve it. You really, really do. And get sleep.